really has been an honor and a pleasure for me to be part of this important effort sponsored by HRSA and through the Marshall Dine Foundation. As you could very well tell, there's tremendous amount of work that has been ongoing through the different communities that you have heard from. A lot of diversity in some of the approaches. And one of the roles that we have as national evaluators is to be able to, first of all, determine eventually the promising practices that are emerging from the different sites, the lessons learned and challenges. And to be able to do that, our center started first in engaging in process evaluation to be able to see to what degree we captured all the different processes that have taken place so we could be able to somehow put that in a writing format that would allow all the community who are interested in similar kinds of effort to engage some kind of a roadmap in engaging in similar activities focusing on diverse population. So to begin with, the role of the center in general in this effort is primarily to work with local evaluator. The way that this has been structured is that we have every site that you have heard from has local evaluator who are capturing processes in this entire activity, and then working with us, trying to see to what degree we could be able to come up with indicators, with measurements, with ways of being able to do justice on the tremendous amount of work that is taking place. And in that process, we wanted for this particular presentation just to focus on how we truly believe that community participation and engagement is critical as we discuss cultural competency issues. All the different sites has the mandate to try to develop linguistic and cultural competency program on genetic education. But how can we be able to capture that has been one of the challenges and one of the things that we are trying to address. So the goal here is not to necessarily focus on what we have learned in the process evaluation in the last 2 years, but more how can we move that, as I said to you, in focusing on participatory approaches and cultural competency and linguistic approaches way. So in that process, the first thing that we need to take into consideration are the principles that guide the community-based approaches. And some of the principles identified by the local evaluators and working obviously through Marshall Dine, HRSA, and the different project staff is that there has to be active and meaningful participation of community-based organizations and representative of consumer groups in all phases of the project. So here you could tell that community empowerment is viewed as a philosophy, as a process, as an outcome, and it has been tried, as we work with the different sites, try to assure that there is evidence in everything that they're doing in trying to engage the community in making this community education program that they're developing and other products sensitive and culturally appropriate and linguistic appropriate to those communities. Respect and equal partnership. We think that this is critical. It's critical when you work with communities and you focus in on issues of disparity. It's critical this sense of mutual respect and equal partnership in the process. Recognition and valuing community contribution. So how can we be able to capture those kinds of way of acknowledging the contribution and how we recognize those critical aspects of the community norms and values in the process? Commitment to equity and democracy, democratic processes in decision making. How can we be able to assure that our stakeholders, our community leaders, our community residents are really providing meaningful input in the development of the educational materials? And to what degree that commitment is translated in a way that would lead to high quality programs and services? And then another principle that was adopted was this commitment to share responsibility for the interpretation of findings and for dissemination and utilization of results. To what degree the community are also involved in those kind of aspects along the line. So for this particular project, there are several cultural linguistic competency definition that we're trying to adopt. We haven't really reached a complete consensus actually today in the grantee meeting that will follow with the merchant dining in the different sites. And also tomorrow, we're going to be discussing how can we be able to deal with some of this issue of defining cultural and linguistic competency and what are the indicators based on the process measure that we are sharing. So here we're using the definition of the integration and transformation of cultural knowledge about individuals and group of people into specific standard policy practices and attitude that will be used in an appropriate cultural setting to increase the quality of services and produce better outcome. In other words, there's different ways that when you look at the research literature, different ways in which cultural competency has been alluded to. Some of them is how you could be able to improve relationship between patient and physician or client and provider, and how you could be able to engage in cross-cultural communication to make sure that that interaction, that rapport that are established is one that really reflect the understanding, the sensitivity of the norms and the culture of those individuals that we are providing services. But for this particular project at this stage, we are trying to see how can we be able to assess the community organizational perspective. What ingredients, what needs to be there? How can we be instrumental in changing cultural norms, practices of organizations? So it's not the focus so much on individual, because the different project that you have heard from is focusing not on individual intervention, but intervention that is aimed at community, educating a group of individuals that represent diverse groups in terms of racial and ethnic minority. So in this process, we're trying to see how can what needs to take place to be able to focus on organizational kinds of issues. So in taking that in consideration, then the definition is that there has to be a set of values and principles that demonstrate behavior, attitude, policy, and structure that enable then organization to work effectively cross-culturally. And there has to be the capacity to value diversity. How can we be able to capture how different community organizations, and not necessarily community-based, because you have universities involved in other entities reflecting departments of health, but how can we be able to capture the whole issue of value diversity that tells us that they value diversity, that they conduct self-assessment, that they manage the dynamic of differences, that they acquire an institutionalized cultural knowledge and adapt the diversity and the cultural context of the community that they serve. So again, it's moving the whole aspect from individual cultural competency and the ability to relate well with individuals that have different cultural norms and beliefs to moving into institutional policy and patterns of behavior that hopefully will be institutionalized as organization attempts to move into cultural competency effort. Then you have that part of this effort is to incorporate all those aspects in terms of policy making, administration, administrative and practices, services delivery, and systemically involved consumer, particularly key stakeholders and community. And the cultural competency is a developmental process that evolves over an extended period. Both individuals and organizations at various levels of awareness, knowledge, and skills along a cultural competent continuum. So for us to be able to try to capture the linguistic and cultural competency effort, we focus a lot on the process evaluation, and a report already is under development that we are, I have 5 minutes, thank you, Amy. That is trying to, that already have tried to capture or summarize many of the processes that you have heard. That report, I'm not going to be highlighting any of those findings because it's still under review, as we just recently received comments from our funders to make sure that we have really done justice, and we need to share that with the different sites. And so the ultimate assessment will be to develop a tool that will be quantifying the cultural competency. So it would have a series of cultural indicators that would allow us to be able to get to this whole concept, to grab this whole concept that we call cultural competency. And so not only the document that I alluded to is in process, but we're also going to be having another series of documents that will be able to document the extent to which the program planning reflects the cultural competency element. So in the process question that were alluded for this particular phase, Some of the questions says, who are the key stakeholders involved in the project? And many of the local site already have alluded to some of their stakeholder. Are their roles well defined? Is it clear who does what and when? What outreach activity has been made, you know, in terms of reaching those community groups? How have they been involved in the planning process? Do representatives from client groups have meaningful input into the planning process? Why and why not? What are the positive and negative aspects of community and client participation? How is cultural competency reflected in the planning stages of the project from the local site perspective? And then some of the things that have emerged is that different sites define community slightly different, and that is needs to be captured in any kind of instrument of cultural diversity. The history of engaging community members in planning and development activity is critical. Different groups have different experience, level of comfort in trying to reach out to community and engage them based on their either previous experience in working in similar activity or not. The project goals also tend to affect to what degree the program will be aiming at trying to maximize that community engagement and maximizing the community knowledge of community norms. And so we're looking and trying to capture the cultural dimension from the client culture and from the organizational culture, as I alluded to a few minutes ago. And so some of the many discussions that have taken place has been based on roundtable discussion with the local evaluators, discussion individually conference call with the different sites, reviewing the literature review, and trying to obtain input from program planners and community participants directly. And so some of the key dimensions of this tool that we are developing include dimension to evaluate or measure linguistic competency, the measurements or indicator for community participation and the degree of the community participation, and then to what degree there is evidence about cultural values, beliefs, and practices integrated in the development of the different promising practices that have been described today. And so some many criteria that are under consideration is whether staff is bilingual or in some site trilingual or biculture, the media messages and print materials to what degree really reflect the norms and values and attitudes of the community in question. The materials, to what degree was translated and what some of the challenges in doing those translation, to what degree they were developed and tested in the community. And so there are many other aspects that has to do with the community engagement that we are not going to be describing here in detail. But anyway, some of them may involve the credibility to the effort within the community, the cultural perspective, cultural center expertise, cultural resources. And I'm trying to go fast because Emmy Lou said that I'm almost out of time. But in closing, in trying to assess the cultural competency of the many genetic education program under development, it is critical to not only involve the community and be able to assess the degree of involvement in those processes in the planning and implementation, but to be able to come up with a tool that could also reflect some of the family system, values, health beliefs, health behavior, religious belief, and many other components that are critical in getting a better understanding about this. So I want to close with that, and I want to thank the local evaluators who are here, of the different sites who have been instrumental in working closely with us in all the different stages of the evaluation. Our next step is primarily engaging, moving from process evaluation to outcome evaluation. So all the many programs that have been described here, there's going to be a pre-assessment, post-assessment, then there's going to be a six-month, one-year follow-up, depending on the specific intervention in question. So we could be able, in hopefully in future presentation, provide some quantitative information about how well those programs, those promising practices, are really engaging in achieving their goals.
Okay, this is the CGEN project is a huge project with a lot of moving parts, and I also wanted to give recognition to the local evaluators, and if you could just stand up or raise your hand, Dr. Dr. Stacey Eddings from Bob Carson, who's evaluating the Utah project, Dr. Joanne Mantle, buddy from Howard University right here in D.C., and Jesus Sanchez from the NYU Child Study Center. I also wanted to give thanks to our funders who supported this project, the HRSA, Maternal Child Health Bureau Genetic Services Branch, and Michelle Currier. Dr. Michelle Currier is also here in the room with us today. Now it's time for questions, and we have about 10 minutes for folks to ask some questions, and I'll repeat the question here for you. So, over there.
Absolutely. We actually dedicated an entire module, an entire session on discussing the legal, ethical, and social implications of genetics. Taking into consideration the fact that we are living in communities that are very underserved and where there are higher levels of pollution, where there are other factors affecting the health of our communities, such as poverty, literacy level. We talked about the experience of immigration as a stressor that can also contribute to the detriment of the health of the communities. And we are advocating for the community to participate in the development of policy that addresses the fact that when it comes about genetics, first of all, we don't necessarily believe in the genetic determinism of a disease. We believe more that it depends on what happens in the interaction with the environment, and that we need to make changes in the environment also to make sure that the health disparities are reduced in our community and that the health outcomes of the Latino community improves.
This is a very important question, and actually, prior to the community genetic network, there was another project sponsored by HRSA through the Marshall Dying that was aimed at really forming coalitions in different racial and ethnic minority community with the aim of for them to develop an understanding about the advances in genetics and how critical was for community leaders to have a sense of control and make sure that there is policy in place that will be safeguarding some of the many potential abuses and discrimination that may occur as the science moved forward. And actually, when we started working with Rosita Romero in the Washington High with the Dominican residents there, one of the things that Rosita, I remember if I could cite you, Rosita, is the fact that she wasn't aware about all this at that time when we started that particular project several years ago. She wasn't aware about the tremendous amount of implications about the advances in science and how she felt as a community leader to really get involved in engaging in genetic education and bringing the awareness in the community just for the same reason that you just alluded to. And so that was similar experiences that I remember at that time with Flint and East Lansing with the African American community. The research that were conducted at that time based on focus group in some site and at that time based on community survey, clearly the community, particularly the leadership with more higher level of education, was very much concerned about all the negative potential implication and how this would lead to further discrimination of racial and ethnic minority in terms of getting insurance coverage or really being stigmatized on certain kinds of conditions and illnesses. So that is a very good question, and to many degree, my understanding is that many of the sites are addressing that with their community advisory board.
Thank you, Dr. Ticello. James?
I'm James Lear from Genetic Life. I had a question. You referred to that people wanted more information on genes and environment and more information on really basic information first. And I know that there's a lot of communities involved in this project. In our project, which works in family health history as well, we kind of found that people weren't as interested in genes and base pairs and DNA. They were interested in, you know, what makes them unique, why diseases run in the family, really basic information that, you know, why not even why is genetics important to me, but why is this whole discussion of kind of heredity and diseases important to me, like a much more basic level. And I was wondering where, you know, where the information you're experiencing made you come down on that topic. Should we be focusing on genes at all at this point? Should we be focusing on more basic information just on family health history? Should we be mixing them together? You know, what type of information do people actually need to know, and what information do people want to know?
And I'd open that question to the panel, because everyone here actually came into the project with a needs assessment done that helped them to decide what particular topics that they were going to focus on, but I'd like to open up the panel to answer that question.
My focus is on the prenatal women, the pregnant women. You're absolutely right. Many years ago, you know, we've been trying to focus to introduce the concept of genetic 100, the gene, you know, the formation and all those kind of things. But you're right, is that what the women want to know? After the genetic counselor spent so much time in explaining the introduction, the genetic 100, and then by the time they get to the point that they want to tell the woman why you're here and you need to think about, consider amniocentesis, the woman have no clue, because she cannot connect the genetic 100 to the procedure that needs to be done. So that's why with this project, before the woman actually go in to see the genetic counselor, we already have someone that who try to introduce the genetic 100 in a very, very basic user-friendly term. That's why, you know, we go through the whole process of reviewing and the approval of the curriculum and the workshop and the material with this group of women. So it was a big help. So, you know, with the outcome, they actually feel that I am learning what I want to hear from the genetic counselor, rather than giving me all this, you know, terminology that is out of my head.
In addition to that, even working with the African-American community, we are concentrating our materials, our handbooks. One is called Planning for a Healthy Future. And the reason why it is called Planning for a Healthy Future is because people respond to their future. They respond to what is important for their family, especially in the African-American community and all the other communities. Family is very important. And so that we realized that if we could focus on their future, and to them, a lot of that means their children. So they think about their children more, and we try to appeal to that, even though our focus is the African-American family, which constitutes children, adults, seniors. And so we try to reach the entire gamut, because we found that a lot of seniors are actually interested in family history, not necessarily family health history. So we're working on with our seniors to say, hey, you have family health, family history information. Now let's collect the health information and let's follow that along. There are a lot of churches in D.C. that actually have different groups, and we are beginning to work with some of those different groups. And also the Zeta Phi Beta sorority, they're involved in the Human Genome Project, and they have a very, very, very good program that they're doing. And one of the members there I'm collaborating with, she focuses on that she has a game that talks about family health history. And so this is just one of the creative approaches that actually gets people involved, because people, they don't really relate, as Rebecca said, the genes and the DNA and all of that. And so we only have one or two pages about that, but we feel it is necessary to kind of explain the basics so we can go into and say, okay, make the connection between genes, family health history, your children, your future, and so on.
Okay.